Hafton Weil, because Mark Jeffers has already worked there, started his career there, in fact, in none other than Carroll's group. I don't believe in coincidences. I'm still trying to work out the implications of that when Julie taps and enters briskly, her generous mouth unusually strained. Sorry, Kate, I have an Alina. She checks the post-it in her hand. Harcourt here for you. Harcourt? But that's Seb's surname. It doesn't fit with anyone else. And then I twig. But what on earth is Seb's wife doing here? Julie is still speaking, her eyes anxious behind the tortoiseshell-rimmed glasses. I did say you have quite a busy schedule. Do I? I check the diary, conscious it should have been the first thing I did when I got back to the office. And it's true, I have a few calls coming up. It's hard to reason through how I should respond to this sudden intrusion, to what would constitute a normal response when I feel so far from normal. I suppose I could legitimately send Alina away. It's what I would prefer to do, but I can't help wondering what has driven her here in the first place. I wouldn't imagine she's someone given to impulsive social calls with no warning. She's far too well-mannered for that. It's okay, Julie. She's the wife of a friend. Reluctantly leaving my desk to greet my unexpected guest, I find her looking out of the window in the outer room, a sleek grey wool coat buttoned almost to her neck, the belt highlighting her as yet slim waist. Above the collar, her long dark blonde hair is coiled into a smooth roll. She turns her head as I emerge from my office, and I see her quickly rearrange her features into a smile. Her makeup is impeccable. She must have taken a great deal of care over it. Alina, I say, finding a smile from somewhere. I kiss her on both cheeks after a slight hesitation that I hope is imperceptible. That's the point of etiquette, I think, to provide a framework of actions to cling to, even when your world is falling apart. I need to rely on that. This is a surprise. How are you? She doesn't answer the question. I'm so sorry for turning up unannounced. She glances around, a quick frown crosses her face before she smooths it away. You're not a lawyer, are you? I ask, conscious of Julie hovering behind me. Oh no, Lord no, I capital raise for private equity. Alina glances round again. The practicalities seem to be catching up to her. Perhaps she hadn't been expecting me to share an office. A social call, then, I say. Alina's eyes fly to my face. They're hazel, almost yellow. Come on, then. Let's nip out for coffee where we can chat freely. Whatever she has to say, I'm quite sure I don't want Paul or Julie to hear it. Alina nods swiftly. Perfect, she says, relief evident even in her clipped tones. I am sorry to disturb you, but as I was passing it seemed silly not to drop in. She's a smart girl. She's caught on. I ask Julie to reschedule my calls and then grab my coat, which seems very shabby next to Alina's sleek number, and Alina and I head across the road to the nearest coffee shop. I have to stretch my mind to think of what one might ordinarily say in this situation. Follow the rules, stick to the etiquette. The ordinary steps of life will pull me through. How are you feeling? I ask. Are you still struggling with morning sickness? That, she says without looking at me, her mouth a thin, tight line, is the least of my worries. Then she relents, perhaps realizing how combative she sounded. But yes, I'm still struggling. God knows what this poor thing is surviving on. I can hardly keep anything down. We're at the door of the cafe now. I sit Alina down at a table and queue to buy her a cup of tea and some plain biscuits, ignoring her protestations that she should be the one paying. When I return to the table, she has peeled off the tailored coat to reveal a white silk blouse and a neat pencil skirt. The effect is simple, understated, elegantly attractive but not sexy. It entirely suits her. She reaches for the biscuits immediately. Thank you. You're welcome. I study her as she peels open the packet, trying to fit her into Seb, like a two-piece jigsaw puzzle. She looks up as if she feels my eyes on her, picking over her hair, her clothes, the way she holds herself. "You must be wondering what on earth I'm doing here," she says, without a trace of a smile, when she has finished a biscuit. Her delicately prominent collarbones spread like open wings from the two raised nubs at the base of her throat. Her wrists are slender, leading to long, slim fingers. It seems like her very bones have been carefully crafted to fit the image she wishes to portray. Refined, elegant, unmistakably upper class. "Yes," I say. I glance at my mobile phone, which I have placed face up on the table. My lawyer hasn't rung. "You used to date my husband?" I blink. "Yes. Is that a problem?" Her eyes are an unusual hazel color and fixed unswervingly on my face. I almost laugh. For a moment I'm tempted to paraphrase her own words. "That's the least of my problems." Instead I say evenly, "Not for me." She eyes me carefully without speaking for a moment, then reaches for another biscuit. "Good," she says, with some satisfaction, as if I've confirmed something important to her. "I didn't know anything about your history with Seb until the other day," she remarks. "Caro told me." There's an unmistakable twist of her lips on Caro's name. "Actually, I'd rather assumed you were with Tom." I don't want to hear his name, yet I'm also greedy for something, anything, that relates to Tom and me, to an us that has never been. I have to stop myself from asking why she assumed that. Instead, I say mildly, "I wouldn't think you're here to ask me that, though." "No." She puts down the biscuit without having taken a bite. Once again I'm caught in her hazel gaze. She ticks all the boxes I had always imagined Seb's wife would have to tick. But still, she is not what I expected. She's more reserved, more intelligent, more herself. I wonder if Seb has gotten rather more than he bargained for. "I rather think Caro is trying to steal my husband," she says, without preamble or apology. "He's in quite a bad place at the moment. His job. The drinking. I know you were at Tom's last night, so I hardly need to bring you up to speed on that. Only two red spots high on those perfectly sculpted cheekbones reveal the humiliation I know she must feel on discussing her husband's failings with a near stranger. The thing is, it's Caro who is getting him so worked up about it all. Ever since they reopened the investigation on that girl, she's been on the phone non-stop, trying to get her little tendrils into him." She stops abruptly, cutting off the passion that was threatening to spill into her words. I stare at her. This is so far from what I was expecting. Not that I knew what I was expecting, but this isn't it, that I have to mentally shake myself into responding. "They're not having an affair," I say at last. Perhaps it's a good thing this is such a strange conversation. I can be forgiven for being a little slow on social cues. It wouldn't be appropriate to say what I'm thinking. "I'm about to be arrested for a murder that in all probability was your husband's fault, so please excuse me if I can't get worked up about the state of your marriage." "I didn't think they were. Not yet, at least. Though I'd be interested to know what makes you say that." One part of me notes that the control she has of her emotions is terrifyingly impressive. "Caro kept ringing last night. He wouldn't pick up. Tom asked why she kept calling, and Seb told him he wasn't sleeping with her, if that's what he was thinking. He said he never had." I remember the words escaping his mouth in the dim living room, and more besides. "Barely even kissed her." So he did kiss her. At least once then. I wonder when. Probably sometime when they were teenagers. Not that it matters. Not that any of it matters. But she's here and so am I, and there are emotions I should go through. I shrug. "So if you believe in the old saying, in vino veritas, I do, actually, she says thoughtfully. Perhaps I detect a slight relaxation within her, but equally I could be imagining it. She looks at the biscuit carefully for a moment, as if considering if it's worth the risk, but it remains on the table in front of her. She looks at me again. Thank you. You're welcome. I'm still puzzled as to what she's here for. Tom said you and Caro don't really get on. Tom. Well, we certainly didn't in the past, but that was a long time ago. I thought perhaps you would be a good person to speak to. My enemy's enemy is my friend. But I see Caro again, admitting to her own mother's disapproval, and I feel that moment of warmth between us. Caro is not an enemy, nor a friend either. I'm not sure I know the correct word in the English language to describe what she is to me. Though if she really is to blame for the Mark Jeffers situation, I'm sure I'll find one. Exactly. Alina smiles briefly, a genuine smile, not one out of politeness. On another day, I know it would feel like a gift. I don't believe Alina offers a genuine smile terribly often. I don't really know what happened in France. Seb doesn't like to talk about it. He says he doesn't want me to worry about anything with the baby coming. She frowns. But whatever happened, I think it's somehow giving Caro some, I don't know, leverage over him. And quite frankly, I find that rather more irritating than the investigation. I mean, it's not as if Seb would really have killed a random girl, is it? He should have nothing to worry about. But she has him all worked up. He's talking to her and not to me. And I need to find a way to put a stop to it. I look at her blankly. Surely as Seb's wife, she must know more than this. But there is no artifice in her face, simply frustration and a hefty dislike of Caro. Seb really hasn't filled her in. It's probably not my place to do it either. But in spite of my preoccupation, my distance, I do have some empathy for her. She shouldn't be left in the dark. Alina, I say carefully, you do know that Seb slept with Severine, don't you? The girl who died. That he was the last person to see her alive. Her eyes fly to my face. That's not... I don't... She starts to shake her head and then stops considering, a frown corrugating her ordinarily smooth forehead. But I thought he was going out with you then, she says, confused. He was, I say wryly. Oh. Expressions flit quickly over her face before it settles on a look of resignation. I rather think I'd better hear about all of this from you. So I tell her the bare facts, bereft of any speculation, though I leave out the garden rake since that's information I'm not supposed to possess. She listens carefully, those yellow-brown eyes taking account of me throughout. At the end she blows out a breath and mutters fiercely, "Damn you, Seb!" Her words catch me and throw me years back to a time when I would have been the one with such exasperation in my voice. I'm sorry, I admit truthfully. She doesn't answer. She has finally picked up the biscuit and is working her way through it. Well, it wouldn't have been Seb, she says definitively when the biscuit is gone. I mean, why on earth would he want to kill her? The police can't possibly suspect him. They might think it was an accident. She waves it away. But you know what he's like when he's drunk. He passes out. He can't hold his own body weight, let alone carry someone to a well. Someone else might have done that bit. Who? She says, disbelieving. Tom? Caro? I see the precise moment the penny drops. The colour leeches out of her face, and her mouth works wordlessly before she clamps her lips together. I don't say anything. There's nothing to say. Leverage, she finally says, almost hisses, though more to herself than to me. That fucking bitch. She looks across at me again. Is this what the police think happened?
No, luckily for your husband, the police think it was me. This is what I, Kate Channing, think happened.
I don't know. This can't be happening, she mutters again to herself. Then louder, looking at me fiercely this time. This can't be allowed to happen.
At that moment, my mobile rings out. I grab it as if it's a lifeline.
My lawyer, sorry, I've got to take this.
I duck outside the cafe before she can answer.
Interesting, says Ms., Miss., or Mrs. Streeter, when I've downloaded Lara's discoveries. Not enough, though, even if the rake shows up your DNA or anyone else's. Still simply circumstantial.
Circumstantial enough to make it to trial? I left my coat at the table with Alina. I wrap my free arm around myself, shivering a little. I can feel my ribs beneath my thin wrap dress. They feel worryingly insubstantial. I am too breakable for what life is throwing at me. She's silent for a worryingly long pause.
Ordinarily, no, she says at last. But with the political pressure on this one, it's hard to say. Have you thought any more about cooperation?
Yes. Cooperation, a deceptive word. It sounds so collegiate, warm and friendly. Yet in truth it's slyly partisan, with its own agenda. Cooperation with the police means betrayal of someone. But who? Seb? Caro? Both? I never thought I was someone who would stoop to this. Yet here I am.
And?
I close my eyes and speak in a rush.
Caro had cocaine. She smuggled it into France in my suitcase. I knew nothing about it. That's what the arguments were about on the last night. I found out she'd done that. I honestly didn't think it had any bearing, so I never wanted to bring it up.
I open my eyes. I never mentioned the drugs all those years ago, and I haven't mentioned them up to now. But in the space of a few short seconds, all that counts for nothing. It's done. I wonder what Tom will think of me for it, and then I have to screw my eyes tightly shut again, to block out the opprobrium I imagine in his face.
Did you take any drugs that night?
Her voice is clipped, tightly professional.
No.
At any point during the holiday?
No, it's really not my thing. Ask anybody.
Believe me, the police will.
Have you ever taken any drugs?
She continues, unrelenting.
What, ever in my life?
Ever, as in, at any point whatsoever. I smoked pot once or twice at uni, but it just sent me to sleep. Plus, I don't like smoking.
Once or twice, be specific.
Twice then, certainly not three times.
Okay.
She has finally relaxed a little. I can hear the tension easing out of her voice.
Okay, that's good. I can definitely work with that. Anything else?
Well, I don't know what time Seb came to bed. Through the cafe window I can see a side view of the abandoned Alina, sitting where I left her at the table. One hand is resting on her crossed legs, her thumb beating out an unsteady high-speed tattoo. I don't know what time Seb came to bed. The words are there, fully formed in my head, waiting to be sent forth into the world.
Yes?
I look at Alina again. She has stilled her thumb with her other hand, but her ankle is jittering now.
Sorry, something just distracted me here.
No, nothing else.
Okay, then. I'll set up a meeting with the detective and get back to you. This is good, Kate. It's helpful.
Great. The word sounds thin.
Oh, and Kate?
Yes?
If you have anything more to offer,
now's the time.
Think hard.
Then she disconnects. The cold overrides my reluctance to return to Alina, pushing me back into the cafe. Alina looks up as I enter.
Sorry about that, I say, as I drop into the seat opposite her.
You have a lawyer.
It's almost an accusation.
Yes. Does Seb have a lawyer?
Her manner is definitely more hostile.
I'm the messenger, I realize. She'd really quite like to shoot me. And Seb too, I expect, for putting her in this position, of being the last to know.
I don't know, but if he doesn't, he should get one.
He didn't do it, she says tightly. I know him. You know him. You know he didn't have anything to do with it.
I can't bring myself to say anything. Her eyes widen.
Oh my God, she says, genuinely stunned. You actually think it was him?
Look, I don't know what happened, I protest weakly, but she's not mollified.
How could you? You went out with him. You know him.
I can see the shock turning to bitter fury inside her, and I find myself mentally cheering her loyalty, even as I cringe in the face of it.
I just... Look, I don't think your Seb is the same as the Seb I went out with. We've all changed a lot since then.
Still, she insists fiercely, her eyes boring into mine,
he wouldn't have done that.
She waits imperiously for me to respond, and there is nothing else I can do. I nod. She nods her head sharply, acknowledging her win without any joy, then continues.
I bet Caro's trying to make him think he was involved somehow, responsible even. She's probably pretending she's covering up for him, to make him rely on her. That's the leverage she has. I bet she's been doing it for years, actually. He's always been on the booze more after she's been around.
I cock my head. Alina may be onto something. It would be just like Caro to milk every advantage out of the situation. A confused, guilt-ridden Seb, who owes an enormous debt to Caro, is surely much more likely to succumb to her wiles. Alina happens to think the debt is manufactured rather than real, but either way, I can see a twisted Caro logic at work. I can just imagine her, late at night, sending poison-laden whispers down the phone line to slither into Seb's ear and take residence, curled inside his desperately worried mind. At least, it would be just like the Caro I thought I knew. But now I wonder. Now there's the possibility of an alternative interpretation in my mind. Maybe Caro phones Seb because she can't help herself, because she's hopelessly in love with him. It would be just like Seb to carelessly lead her on, to be the one delivering to her ear sweet nothings carried on whispers that really are nothing at all, except a vehicle for the ego boost he needs. Perhaps he drinks after she's been around out of guilt. Then I think again of Mark Jeffers, and I'm back to Caro as poison whisperer.
And anyway, says Alina, in a sudden change of pace, surely there's an obvious alternative suspect.
I wait dumbly. Does she mean me? Surely she wouldn't suggest that in front of me, though to be fair, I have just been casting aspersions about her husband.
Theo.
I shake my head. Nobody thinks it was Theo.
Why not? Did he have an alibi?
No. Well, I mean, yes. He was with Caro, I think. But I suppose that he went to bed at some point.
He's dead,
she interrupts bluntly.
Which is obviously quite horrible for him and his parents and everyone who loved him. But all of you are still alive, with lives ahead of you to live. Surely if the blame is to fall on any of you, you might as well make it fall on him.
The brazen suggestion takes my breath away.
What you're suggesting?
I trail off. I should finish with, is immoral, or is illegal, or is an obstruction of justice, but somehow I can't bring myself to spell it out. Theo as prime suspect. Alina thinks she's simply getting rid of the Caro problem. But it would get me off the hook too, of course. A wave of longing sweeps over me, a longing to be free of the weight that presses down on me, beating me a little smaller, a little weaker every day, to be free of the broiling sea of fear that sits in my stomach and threatens on occasion to erupt from my throat and overwhelm me. Yes, Alina says, her steady gaze fixed on my face despite the blush that betrays her emotions. I know what I'm suggesting. I look at the cold fire within the yellow-brown eyes, and I don't doubt her. Seb is so very lucky to have her, grimly fighting in his corner despite no doubt being utterly furious with him. But this particular Sally seems too well considered to have just come to her, whilst I've been braving both the cold and my lawyer's interrogation outside. Is this what you wanted to speak to me about? She considers denying it, but evidently plumps for the truth. Yes. She shrugs, a glorious sweep upward of the tips of the outspread wings of her collarbones. She should have been a ballet dancer. She has the frame for it, and something else too, something in her every gesture, each leading seamlessly into the next, that makes it seem like she's moving through a larger choreographed hall. It doesn't really matter whether I'm right about what Caro's leverage is. If all of this goes away, then so does she. And you think you'll get your husband back? Tom will never go for it, I say at last. And now I've skipped over the morality too. I'm focused on whether her plan can actually be executed. I wonder when I lost faith in the legal system, French or otherwise. Or perhaps it's not a lack of trust in the legal system that's to blame. Perhaps it's just that I know all too well that life isn't always fair. Therefore, how can you expect the law to be? I shiver. Don't think about being arrested. He won't? She raises her eyebrows. Not even for Seb? I realize I don't know. Even yesterday I would have said that Tom would do anything for Seb. But now? The bitterness in Seb's voice last night. The tightness of Tom's face when Seb revealed he'd known all along that Tom was angling for me. I don't know who Tom would choose. Theo or Seb. I don't know. And you? She watches me closely, those slender wrists sweeping up to clasp together by her chin. A picture of poise. Once again I'm in awe of her control, all the more because I have an inkling of what's beneath it. What would it take to push Mordan down this road? I imagine him strolling along the dusty lane by the farmhouse, sunshine beating down on the shoulders of his immaculate suit, as he ambles and constructs an argument in his mind for Theo as murderer. Perhaps that could indeed come to pass, if he were the recipient of a few well-chosen comments, a few hints. Lies. Lies all. Lies and a betrayal of Theo. Would that betrayal really be any worse than revealing Carol's cocaine use? I could claim that was only what she deserved, given I'm sure she's spreading rumours about me through Mark Jeffers. But the truth is that as soon as I felt cornered, I barely hesitated. I'd have done it without the Jeffers info. Again, I wonder what Tom will say about that. Kate, prompts Alina. I'll think about it. At the least, I have given her a genuine response. I will probably think about little else. Chapter 18. I'm saved from having to bring Tom up to speed. It appears Lara has done that for me. He calls me that evening and sounds almost desperate. Jesus, Kate! The garden rake! I've just been looking up the French for it. Rateau! I thought she said Bato. It was Ratto. What? Who said? What do you mean? I'm on my mobile in my living room. I quickly hunt for the remote to kill the sound of the television program that I'd been hoping would hold my interest sufficiently to calm the vicious storm of my thoughts. As the characters turn abruptly silent, it occurs to me I have no idea what I've been watching. I saw Severine. I saw her go into the barn with Seb. But I saw her again after they, you know, she was coming past the pool, and she had blood on her face, not much, just a bit, nothing to cause alarm. I'm not sure I have ever heard Tom, steady, reliable Tom, talk in such a stream of consciousness. I asked her if she was all right, I didn't really get the gist of it at the time. She didn't have the right English word. She kept saying bateau. At least I thought it was bateau, but it must have been ratto.
I see a brief image of Severine in the darkened barn, her slim foot stepping on the fanned-out prongs of the garden rake, the other end flipping up to smack her in the face, Abbott and Costello style. It ought to be funny, but it's not.
I just thought she wasn't making a lot of sense. There wasn't a boat around for miles, but then we'd all had a lot to drink, so I put it down to that at the time. And she waved me away fairly forcibly and headed off, so I thought she was rather sensibly putting herself to bed.
Why didn't you tell the police? Then or now even?
He sighs down the phone. I thought I was protecting Seb. I mean, I see a girl with blood on her face, who subsequently disappears. In retrospect, I started to wonder if she wasn't drunk. Maybe she was severely concussed. I mean, she was babbling about boats. Except she wasn't. Fuck! But given she was coming from the barn with Seb, I didn't want to implicate him in any way, so I just...
kept silent. I finish for him. I sink back on my sofa, the phone pressed against my ear.
Yes. Yes. He seems to have run out of steam. He takes a deep breath, then blows it out down the phone. It's an intimate sound. I can imagine his breath stroking my cheek.
But at least they won't find any of your DNA on the rake.
True. I'm silent again, remembering the police taking our DNA samples years ago, in order to easily rule us out, we were told. I didn't demur at all. I simply opened wide for two large cotton swabs. I wonder if I would be more reluctant now in the same circumstances.
But isn't there a saying? The absence of proof is not proof of absence, something like that anyway.
Fuck! I'll never be able to forgive myself if I've made it worse for you, he mutters, half to himself. I don't know yet if he has or hasn't. I'm still trying to work it all through. The police have a murder weapon. That isn't really a murder weapon. It's an inciting item in slapstick comedy.
So what did you think happened to her? I ask at last.
I mean, what did you think at the time?
I thought her head wound must have been much more serious than I realized. One of those freak accident things, that she collapsed and died from it.
As he speaks, I see it happening. Severine in her black shift, sandals hanging loosely from a single finger of one hand. She's passing the pool, barely visible in the darkness, lit only by the shimmering reflection of the moonlight off the water. She takes a step and stumbles, her other hand going to her bloody temple. And then she crumples without a sound.
But no, that isn't what happened, because Severine is here with me, lounging in my armchair.
Only that's not right either, because Severine is dead, except not how Tom is describing.
I find I'm rubbing fiercely at my forehead. My head is throbbing. I've lost the thread of what Tom is saying, but he's still speaking.
I thought Seb found her and panicked, wanted to hide the body, but he'd have been in no fit state to do anything on his own. So someone helped him, Caro or Theo, I thought, or both. I thought they'd driven somewhere and dumped her.
In my car?
I sit up, somehow personally affronted, despite the fact that I know this never happened. I almost know this never happened. I can't keep track tonight.
No, not yours. You were asleep. I didn't believe anyone would have had the guts to go raking through your bags for your keys with you right there in the bed.
I thought they used the Jag.
I blink. The Jag. It was Theo's dad's pride and joy. It had been impressed upon us all never to go near it. In my mind, the Jag was a museum display piece. It hadn't even occurred to me that it could actually be driven.
As far as I know, the police never checked the Jag over, because they thought she went to the bus depot. I always wondered if they would have found her DNA in it. And then when she was found in the well, I figured the same logic applied, just without the Jag.
Wait, so you never thought that was Severine at the bus depot?
No. All the time we were there, Do you remember her ever emerging before 11?
I think about this, remembering Severine coming out to the pool in her black bikini, a chic canvas bag filled with the paraphernalia required for serious sunbathing, whilst also watching the Severine in my living room settle into a more comfortable position.
True. Sometimes not till lunchtime.
Exactly. And with a hangover and a sore head? I doubt we'd have seen her till mid-afternoon.
I missed that point. I should have thought of it, but I missed it in my eagerness to believe Severine was at the bus depot, that her death had nothing to do with any of us. What do you think happened now?
I've been thinking about that, he says slowly. Modan said her bones were damaged, consistent with a hit and run.
The Jag! I exclaim.
Yes, that's what I thought. Theo's dad told me the police have been over every inch of the Jag for evidence. He told me he'd looked up how long it takes DNA to degrade, and apparently it depends on the conditions. Takes millions of years in ideal conditions like ice, but not very long in heat or sunlight. The Jag has always been kept under cover in a garage, though, so I expect that means any DNA will be usable. I imagine right now Modan has some lab running tests on any DNA recovered. He'll be testing against all of us, I bet.
It would have to be Caro, Theo, or Seb, I say slowly.
Yes. I don't know which one, or even if we're on the right track.
He sounds strained.
It doesn't make any sense. You'd have to be gunning the accelerator to hit someone hard enough to kill them, so then it's hardly an accident anymore.
Now I see Severine, in the same black shift, the sandals still swinging from a single finger, except now she's caught in headlights, turning in surprise, raising a futile arm to block her face.
Which means the police will probably think you have the most obvious motive.
Jealous rage. Spurned lover. We know so much more now, yet nothing has moved on. I'm still the prime suspect. The movie plays out in my head, Severine tossed up in the air like a ragdoll, smashing down on the Jaguar's windscreen, shattering it in a starburst. I look at the Severine in my armchair. She hasn't reacted. Her eyes are closed and her head is tipped back against the cushion, as if she's sunbathing in the dim light of the table lamp and the flickering television. Maybe she is in her reality.
Wouldn't there have been some damage to the car, though?
You'd think so, though sometimes in a crash the bumper looks perfect and all the damage is behind that.
I don't know. Seb was hammered. I suppose he could have fallen asleep at the wheel and hit her, but he's just not that into cars. I can't imagine him climbing in it in the first place.
Theo? I think again of Alina's plan. I don't want to tell Tom about that.
He takes a moment to answer. When he finally speaks up, there's a reluctance infused in every word.
I don't see it, but I didn't expect him to sign up for the army either.
He sighs again.
And Caro doesn't make sense either. Nobody does.
Except me. I sink back on my sofa again.
Always me, I mutter.
Oh, Kate. It's more of a sigh than a sentence. Then gently.
Are you okay? I'm getting worried about you.
No.
Alina wants us all to blame Theo.
I've cut him off with the first thing I can think of, before he can say anything else nice. If he does, I'll cry, and once I start that, I won't stop.
What?
I explain about her ambush of me.
Jesus, he says, when I've finished.
But she's right, he adds thoughtfully. It would be the perfect solution. Not to save Seb, though. To save you.
I'm struck again by his pragmatism. Could you actually do that? I ask, hesitantly.
If it came to that, as a last resort.
He thinks about it seriously.
Yes, I could. I could do it for you,
I close my eyes, close to tears, touched beyond words that he would choose me over Theo.
When this is over, if this is ever over.
What?
I don't want you to go back to Boston, I whisper.
He's quiet. He knows what I'm saying. He's quiet for a second that becomes a minute, a year, a lifetime.
Say something,
I whisper to him. I turn my face to hide it in the sofa cushions.
You chose Seb.
He's whispering too.
I'll always know you chose Seb. Because I didn't know. You didn't even try. You just stepped aside for Seb. You can't hold it against me when you didn't even try.
Another second. Another minute. I can't bear for the silence to lengthen any further.
Don't say anything now. Just think about it. I'm going to be in a French jail anyway.
It won't come to that, he interrupts fiercely. But I ignore him.
So it's probably a moot point, but please, just think about it.
He trails off. All right. I'll think about it.
Night, Tom.
Night, Kate. In the morning, I almost don't go to work. I've slept abysmally. God knows when I last slept well, which I know is a sign of mental stress. But in this case, I think it's rather eclipsed by the fact that I'm regularly seeing a ghost. But at 9 a.m, I'm still in bed. Not sleeping. Not moving. Not doing anything except existing. And I can't even see the point of that. It's a call from Carol that rouses me from my apathy. Pride, it turns out, is a powerful motivator.
Julie said you weren't in yet. Best to try your mobile, says Carol breezily. Having a lie-in, are you? I hope I didn't wake you.
I can sense her sly glee at the idea, and I can't bear to allow her the pleasure.
Actually, no, I've just finished a breakfast meeting with a client.
I lie, remarkably glibly.
Julie must have overlooked it in the office diary.
Oh, right. She sounds temporarily put out, yes, but she rallies.
Well, I really need to meet with you. How's your diary today?
I grab my BlackBerry from the bedside table and flick through.
Today is not great, actually.
It's true. It would be a pretty busy day even without the lawyer and Mordan meeting that looms, darkly, implacable and immovable, in the middle of the afternoon.
Monday would be better.
It really needs to be today, she insists.
What about the end of the day?
I can see I'm not going to be able to put her off.
Well, yes. I suppose I should be able to manage 6:30,
I say reluctantly.
Is there a problem? Have you had second thoughts on anyone we're negotiating with?
No, no, it's not that at all.
Actually, it's more a case of some professional advice, you know, with the partnership process.
That almost floors me. Carol would like to ask my advice?
Really?
Yet again, she has me wrong-footed.
Sure, happy to do whatever I can.
I know you're up against tough opposition. I've done some digging, and from what I understand, Darren Lucas is fighting for the same partnership spot. He's a small, wiry man with a shock of dark hair, a nose to rival Tom's, and a good line in self-deprecating wit. Clients love him, colleagues adore him, and he's a very savvy lawyer. Even when I try to take my own personal bias out of the equation, I can't see how Carol can win this one, unless the firm bows to gender pressure.
Darren? Oh, don't worry about him, she says dismissively.
I blink. Surely Carol is not so naive as to underestimate Darren.
No, I'll explain it all later. See you at my offices at 6:30.
I put down my phone and look around my bedroom. The digital clock reads 9:11. If I'm quick with my shower, I can be in the office before the 10 o'clock call that's in my diary. It's touch and go. I almost pull the covers over my head, but the thought of Carol, old or new, gloating at my slide into depression, pushes me out of bed and into the bathroom. Follow routines, stick to etiquette, I tell myself. It's all that I can think to do. In the warm, streaming water of the shower, it takes me a minute to remember what I'm supposed to do. Shampoo hair, rinse. Condition hair, rinse. Apply body wash, rinse. Another routine, something else to cling to. I pick up my razor, but I don't have the slightest inclination to apply it to any part of me, no matter how fuzzy my legs or underarms might be. Shaving is a hopeful act. I think of Tom on the phone. All right, I'll think about it. I put the razor back down, unused. It doesn't seem as if shaving is called for. As I dry myself off, I see Severine in the mirror, leaning against the bathroom wall behind me. But when I turn round, she isn't there. I wonder again why Carol doesn't see Darren as a threat. I'm missing something. Now there are two things I don't understand where Carol is concerned. This, and what she has to gain by spreading gossip about me, if indeed she is the culprit. It makes me uneasy. Or, even more uneasy. I can't remember when I was last at ease. I don't have long to wait to find out why Carol doesn't think Darren is a threat. It's the first thing Paul says to me, beating even a traditional good morning. Darren Lucas is under investigation at Shaft and Vile for fraud. Can you believe it? My eyes fly to his face, which is filled both with shock and excited importance at being the first to deliver news. Actually, no, I say thoughtfully, mulling it over as I unbutton my coat. I can't. There must be some mistake. What type of fraud? Fiddling is expenses. He shakes his head, disbelief tracking across his face. I can't believe it either. His expenses? Jesus. What could he get out of that? A couple of thousand a year, maybe? Caro, I think. Caro. Then I check myself. Would she really? If it is her, she's playing a very dangerous game. But if it's not her, it's a hell of a coincidence. I consider for a moment approaching... Who? Gordon? Caro's father is hardly going to take kindly to the suggestion that he investigate whether his daughter is framing her rival. A couple of thousand? Absolute max, Paul is saying. Not even that, I would think. Andy's in line for a pay rise of a few hundred thousand if he makes partner. Why on earth would he jeopardize that? He's just not that stupid. But, he frowns, if it was a simple mistake, surely they would have cleared it up straight away. This'll scratch him off the slate, for this year at least. 1 year is all Caro needs. He's being stitched up, I say flatly. Paul looks at me sharply. That's quite a statement. I shrug and avoid his eyes by pulling out my chair and switching on my monitor. I'm just saying it looks that way to me. He continues to look at me, something odd in his eyes. Did you go to the gym or something? He asks abruptly. Your hair is wet. I put a hand to my head. He's right. Did I forget to dry it after my shower? My glance at the window reveals bright sunshine outside, so it didn't rain on me on the way to work. It occurs to me that I can't actually remember getting to work. My hairdryer is broken, I improvise. Oh, he says, but I can feel he's still watching me. What? I say, looking up from my screen. Nothing. He gives an odd shrug. It's just... Julie's a bit worried about you. She said you hadn't been acting yourself. He pauses, then his words trip out over themselves. I just wondered if everything is okay, with the murder investigation, I mean. Oh, well, that's all fine. Nothing to worry about. I'm just... feeling a bit run down is all. I think I'm getting a virus or something. My words don't seem to be enough to convince him. Something else seems to be required. I try a smile, and it does the trick.
He looks relieved. Oh, okay. Well, don't give it to me. I've got a wedding to go to at the weekend.
His words ring in my head as I pull up the files for my 10 o'clock.
She said you hadn't been acting yourself.
Acting. Is that all we humans ever really do? Act and play and present an approximation of something that becomes ourselves? I touch my wet hair self-consciously, frowning. If acting is what's required, it seems that at present, I need to pull out a better performance.
Mordan, again.
I sit in a chair in front of the now familiar chipped desk and watch him apply his easy, dangerous charm to my lawyer, whilst I grip my teeth semi-consciously. If this was all over, could I come to like this man? This man who wants to be my best friend's other half? I wonder. I respect him. I admire him even. But perhaps I will never be able to hold a conversation with him without the sense that he's quietly analyzing, observing, filing information away for a rainy day. Though it's unlikely to be a big problem for me, given that my future social life contains a lifetime of inmates. I shudder. Even my own black humor is failing to amuse me today.
Miss Channing?
From the attention both Mordan and my lawyer are giving me, it may not be the first time Mordan has spoken my name. He's looking at me quizzically, and I almost think I detect sympathy in his chocolate brown eyes. But I can't imagine why that should be. How can he do his job if he feels sympathy for those he believes to be guilty? For some reason this puts me in mind of Caro, and my own ambivalence toward her. Feeling sorry for her, almost liking her at times, yet so often barely able to stand her. I think again of the Russian dolls.
Shall we begin?
And so we do. Miss Streeter, wearing a different lipstick in an equally garish colour, but thankfully much less greasy in application, does some wonderful verbal gymnastics, laying the groundwork. Mordan is, I think, genuinely appreciative of her professional skill. At the end of her monologue, one might be forgiven for pushing for instant canonization of one Kate Channing, on account of her selfless and unstinting cooperation. Except that we all know I'm about to sell someone down the river. And then it's my turn to do just that. I know I can't match Ms. Streeter for linguistic virtuosity, but it turns out I don't need to. She shepherds me gently in the right direction each time, a sentence pushing me here, a comment tugging me there, the words flowing from her mouth to jostle against me, encircling me, as if they alone can keep me safe. Mordan, for his part, is unexpectedly kind. I'm completely lost as to the subtext of this meeting. When I boldly declare Caro's cocaine smuggling, Mordan pauses for the merest second, then continues fluently. He doesn't dispute that Caro put the drugs in my bag. He simply asks about my own cocaine use, as my lawyer warned he would. I say I don't, repeat that I never have. I tell him he can ask anyone, they will all say the same, and he nods briefly. I don't know if that means he agrees with me, or that he will indeed ask around. Perhaps both. He asks about other drug use. I confess the marijuana dabbles, but he's clearly not the least bit interested in that. Caro's cocaine habits come under discussion, but I don't have much to say. I don't know how much she used back then, and I don't know how much she uses now, though I rather suspect she does still use from time to time. But I have nothing to base that on, and I tell Mordan so. We talk about the others at the farmhouse, whether any of them use drugs, but if they have, I've never seen or heard of it. Would any of them have shared the cocaine with Caro that night? I think about it. I can't say for sure, but it seems unlikely to me. Alcohol was the drug of choice for the rest of us. I think of Seb, unable to take his eyes off that slim brown ankle. Not just alcohol. Sex is a drug, too. The discussion moves abruptly to the long drive back. I must have been tired, Mordan suggests, perhaps even hungover. Surely the drive home was shared. I shake my head, tell him no. I repeat that I was the only one insured, and besides, I wasn't that tired. Probably out of all of us, I'd gone to bed the earliest. And I don't remember being very hungover on that drive back. I suppose I must have stopped drinking when we all started arguing. I remember the gulf between Seb and me in the front of the car, so much wider than the gap between our two seats. I remember Caro and Lara sleeping in the back. I remember being furious at Caro for making us leave late. I remember that fury dissipating as I drove, leaving me utterly, desolately miserable. But I don't tell Modan all of that. I just explain why I wasn't tired, and why I wasn't hungover. Not a single one of the questions is specifically about Theo. He hovers peripherally. I mention him obliquely from time to time, but Modan never pays him any attention. Even if I wanted to throw some red-haired, Theo-shaped red herrings into the mix, I can't see how I could achieve it with any degree of subtlety. When Mordan's stock of questions appears to dwindle to nothing, I look across at Miss Streeter. Her neat, cropped head gives me a little nod, which I interpret to mean I've done well. I'm surprised to see we have been here for over an hour and a half, but not surprised to feel exhausted. 10 minutes of Mordan's questions does that, let alone 90 minutes.
Bien,
says Modan. He closes his notebook and stands, adjusting the cuffs of his suit.
Merci. Most helpful, Miss Channing.
He turns his charming smile on me. And it is charming. I want to laugh at myself. How is it that he can pose the danger he does, and yet I am not immune to his appeal?
That is all. For now.
For now. I look at Miss Streeter, but she's already charging into battle.
My client has been nothing but thoroughly cooperative from the start of this process.
Your client forgot to mention Class A drugs on several occasions.
Mordan is smiling, but his eyes are steely.
Understandable, given there's no relevance to the murder investigation, and she was anxious not to get a friend into trouble. It's certainly not a case of obstruction of justice. Your continued interest in my client, without any evidence to link her to the murder, is bordering on harassment. It's disrupting her business and putting enormous stress on her. And I'll be extremely happy to explain that in detail to a judge, so I suggest you either charge her with something or leave her be.
Stress. I blink at the stark reference and open my mouth to protest, but then shut it again silently. In truth, I'm a good bit further down the line than stressed, and perhaps this is not the time to display a stiff upper lip. I glance round quickly for Severine, and find her loitering near the doorway, drawing lazily from a cigarette. The smoke curls upward, partially obscuring a no-smoking sign stuck to the wall. I know she stood there deliberately, and I fold my lips to stifle a grin. Mordan is not in the least bit fazed by Miss Streeter's attack.
Noted,
he says, deep lines bracketing his smiling mouth. He turns to me and the smile drops, though the lines remain. I feel him assess me, though again, I see a kindness in his eyes that confuses me.
I truly do hope you are not too...
He clips his tongue briefly in frustration, searching for the word.
Agitated by the situation. You have been most helpful.
I look at Miss Streeter again, completely nonplussed. She smiles back encouragingly, with a slight air of satisfaction, as if this is all a game and it has played out exactly as she expected. Mordan, too, seems satisfied. I'm the only one in the room who doesn't have the script. Well, Severine, too, but she doesn't care. She doesn't need to care about anything now. Not for the first time I wonder why she cares to hover around me. I don't go back to my office afterward. I should, of course I should. There is plenty to do. But I can't focus. I can't even care that Carol will win today. I call Julie and tell her I'm feeling unwell, which I most definitely am, and that she should cancel my appointments and calls, and then I head for the tube.